WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lanford Wilson, is one of the playwrights who created the off-off-Broadway scene in the 60s. His work was so popular, it ended up on Broadway. John Malkovich starred in the Broadway production of Wilson's Burn This. Wilson won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1980 play, Tally's Folly, one in a series of plays about the Tally family of Lebanon, Missouri, Wilson's hometown. Critic Clive Barnes described the Tally family as having become part of the legend of American theater. Wilson's other plays include Bomb in Gilead and Hot L Baltimore, which set a performance record for off-Broadway theater and became the basis for a TV series of the same name. Wilson is still a member of the Circle Repertory Theater, which he co-founded in 1969. His new play, Redwood Curtain, is about a 17-year-old Amerasian girl who goes in search of her father. She knows he's a Vietnam veteran and suspects that he's one of the homeless vets living in the Redwood Forest of Northern California. Wilson intends to take the play to Broadway. It opened earlier this week in Philadelphia. I spoke with him a few hours before curtain time. We started by talking about how he became a playwright. Wilson told me he was living in Chicago when he discovered he could write plays.
I thought I was going to be a painter, and I was writing stories to sell to magazines in order to support my painting habit. And, of course, I didn't sell anything. And one day I thought of a story and said, oh, that's probably a play, and started writing it as a play and said, what do you know? I'm a playwright. It was as clear as day. So there's only place, there was no theater activity in Chicago at the time at all. And it didn't occur to me to make theater activity in Chicago. A playwright lived in New York, so I had to come to New York.
So you got to New York and...
I hadn't written a play yet. I'd written maybe two little plays, but I was a playwright anyway.
So where did you go to find your connections?
I was very lucky. I've just been very lucky all along. I met someone on the street. They said, what do you do? I said, I'm a playwright. And they said, oh, do you know the Cafe Chino? Never heard of it. All I've heard of is Broadway, of course. I went down to the Cafe Chino, which was had just started the year before doing one-act plays, and introduced myself to Joe Chino, who ran the place. And he said, what sign are you? And I said, Aries. And he said, oh, God, those wild Aries. Why don't you write a play for us? And I did. And then I had a play about every 3 months there, a one-act play for about 4 years.
This is like a small coffee house.
Seat 25, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a small coffee house, and they did a play at 9 and 11. They did a one-act play.
So I guess this is a good, safe, non-threatening way to get started.
Exactly. It was an internship or an apprenticeship. But no one working there knew that. But that's exactly what it was. What better situation than to have a place that will do your play the day you finish it. You start rehearsal the next day if you want to, and you can see it immediately with an audience and see what worked and what didn't, and then write another play.
Now, I know that Joe Chino, who ran the place, killed himself in, I think, 67.
67, right.
And what I read was that he stabbed himself to death 100 times.
About that, probably. He was a crazy Italian. And he was incredibly depressed for over a week. And he put wild opera music on the speakers, stereo in the place, and stabbed himself with a butcher knife. Actually, he was living. He didn't die right then. He was living, and at the hospital, they said they thought he was going to recover. There wasn't brain damage, and he was beginning to recover, and his heart couldn't take the strain, and he had a heart attack and died. He never regained consciousness, but would have.
Was that the most wildly... flamboyantly self-destructive act you'd ever heard of from someone who you knew?
Yes, it was profoundly profoundly depressing. I'd never thought about suicide before that. It had never entered my life. It had never entered my vocabulary. And from that day, it's been a constant presence. It's like your father had killed himself. It's supposed to be a constant presence with the son. So it's been a constant presence since then. And it had never crossed my mind before. Just because we were all so close to him, he was also one of the happiest people I'd ever met, or one of the most joyous persons I'd ever met. And it was just a profound shock. No one could believe it. We all stood around for days outside the place and sat around inside the place, not really knowing what to do with ourselves.
What effect did it have on you as a writer to see...
Well,
see, this happened to somebody who you knew.
The possibility is there in all the characters now. I mean, it's there because it's there in everyone. It's there now in every character you write.
In the late 1960s, you co-founded Circle Repertory Theater in New York. What was the philosophy of the group?
Frankly, we wanted to become the Great American Theater, the Great American Theater Company. But we had done a number of plays. The group, even before we were founded, Marshall and I and Rob Thorkill and Tanya, we'd done a number of plays that had large casts and ensemble acting that just took forever to rehearse and forever to get right. And in order to create an ensemble, you have to totally trust everyone else on stage with you. Because otherwise you're going to make a very large choice, and the actor is going to leave you hanging out there. I've seen actors on stage actually look at the audience like, "What in the hell was that all about?" When someone makes this huge, enormous choice. Well, so the actor, you have to trust that person to be there for you, and if that person is there for you, you can make deeper choices, and that person can make deeper choices, and it just you can just create a much fuller, farther out, more profound experience, and that can only happen in ensemble, or if you happen to know the actor very well, or if you happen to be directed right. And so we wanted to create an ensemble, that kind of an ensemble that would take chances, and would not leave the other person hanging out there. Also, the idea was to do a combination. We're not doing classics now, but for years we did. We'd do two classics and three original plays each year because we wanted to train the actors to do classics and then have that instrument, that classical instrument, available to contemporary writers. In other words, the best actors we could get. And the contemporary writers would teach the actors how to act, and the classics, which would elevate them, and it was to be hoped that the writers would also be stimulated by the classics.
Was it your ambition to get to Broadway, or had you given up on Broadway?
Given up on it completely. We really had no interest in Broadway at all. I think maybe distantly in our mind, there was probably a $3.99 seat house somewhere in the village, where we would end up as our permanent home, but not a Broadway house, because we wanted to do a number of plays a year instead of running something for a commercial run. Nothing had transferred then. Nothing had, when we formed the theater. There wasn't the movement that there is now of plays from regional theaters to Broadway and from off Broadway to off Broadway and off Broadway to Broadway. Things weren't doing that, so it never crossed our mind that that if we had something that was a commercial hit, that we could move it to Broadway.
If you're just joining us, my guest is playwright Lanford Wilson, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lanford Wilson, and his plays include Hotel Baltimore, Tally's Folly, The 5th of July. His new play, The Redwood Curtain, has just opened in Philadelphia. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is playwright Lanford Wilson. One of your early successes was Hotel Baltimore, and this was about people in a hotel that's condemned.
Yes.
And in your early days in New York, you lived in welfare hotels, right?
Right. I first lived at a place that I never did learn the name of it. I think the hotel did not have a name.
Was it called Hotel?
it should have been. It was right across the street from Manhattan Hotel. And they answered the phone with something incomprehensible. I never did hear what it was. It sounded sort of like Hevro. And so we called it the Hevro Hilton. But it was definitely a welfare hotel. And then I moved from there down to the Broadway Central. And the week I moved out of the Broadway Central, the hotel collapsed.
Wow.
It fell completely into the ground. Fortunately, it did it slowly. It did it over a period of about a day and a half, so everyone got out. But I had a lot of experience with that kind of hotel.
Did you lay awake often at night overhearing fights that were happening in the halls or in other rooms?
Like that scene in the movie Big? I just saw the movie Big on television last night. Let's see, did I? When I slept was the hours that I didn't go to sleep until about 8 in the morning back then. And so I had a nice quiet sleep. I was part of the people that was making the noise so other people couldn't sleep, probably.
What were you doing all night?
Well, I was writing, and the whole neighborhood was it was the middle of Needle Park. It was such an enormous shock to me and so thrilling because the neighborhood was filled with hustlers and pimps and prostitutes and drag queens. I'd never seen anything like it in my life.
Not everybody would find that thrilling.
Well, it was thrilling to me. I thought it was the most colorful place I'd ever seen in my life. Also, there were a bunch of guys from Columbia, so I was learning Spanish,
Not Columbia University.
Didn't learn, not from Columbia University. From Columbia and Costa Rica. And Costa Rica University. So I just found it thrilling. I would walk right up to a pusher and say, how exactly does a drug transition work? And where do you get the dope from? And they'd say, get out of here, kid. Because I just wanted to know how everything worked. I thought it was really exciting. So I was usually downstairs in, this is all Baum and Gilead. I was usually downstairs with the Baum and Gilead crowd in that coffee shop.
Yeah, let me explain that Baum and Gilead is a play that takes place in an all-night diner.
An all-night diner,
and it's a diner that's frequented mostly by drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes and other small-time criminals.
Yeah.
So, what attracted you to people like that? You were from the Midwest?
Yeah, from a very proper upbringing in the Midwest. Grew up on a farm. And what did attract me to? I just think it was... It was raw enterprise that attracted me. Everyone was out to make a buck, which is true of everyone everywhere, but it was just so raw and bold and obvious there that when I was writing Baum and Gilead, I always said I could really be writing about Wall Street. It would be exactly the same. And that's what I was trying. I was looking at the economics of it. Also, they had such a great sense of humor about themselves. There were at least five. There was a drag queen and a drug dealer and a fantastic prostitute who just would sit around dishing the dirt, and it was the funniest dialogue I'd ever heard in my life. I didn't ever get the prostitute into a play until I wrote Hotel Baltimore, and then finally the part that Concetta Ferro played. April Green. Finally, I got that prostitute into it. You couldn't say a word to that woman without a comeback.
So what did all the hustlers and con men and drug dealers bring out in you? What surfaced in you?
Oh, I was their pet. I mean, they knew I was writing down every word they said because I would walk up and say, would you repeat that, please? And they thought I was the cutest thing they'd ever seen. You know, they thought I was really very silly, you know. They kind of protected me. I think they felt very protective. When I finished the play Baum and Gilead, I gave it to a couple of people I'd written about, like an idiot, to read and check for errors. And they read it and said, well, that's more or less what it's like, you know.
Do you think if you weren't so naive, it wouldn't have been that easy?
Oh, I'm sure. If I hadn't been that naive, I would have probably been horrified. But and now I'm a little bit shocked at the society that I moved in back then. I can't quite believe that I was in the place when someone was murdered there. That was really horrifying enough. Someone walked in with a knife and stabbed someone and turned around and walked out. We didn't know the person who was stabbed at all. They were from another neighborhood, and we didn't know the people who stabbed him. It was just very alarming, but it was the sort of thing that could easily have happened there at any time. It just hadn't.
Well, after plays like Bomb in Gilead and Hot Old Baltimore, you eventually turned to completely different subject matter, which was a family from the Midwest, the Tally series of
plays. The Tally series, right.
It was a family from the Midwest, from Lebanon, Missouri, which I think is where you're originally from.
Yeah, I was born in Lebanon.
Yeah, so this is a family that's not your family, but
not at all my family.
Okay, yeah, but your family must have some connection to them. So how did you turn from this family that was very exotic, very not like you at all, you know, the Bomb in Gilead crew,
right,
turn from that to a Midwestern family who absorbed you for five plays?
Yeah, I think they were kind of exotic to me. My connection with that family is my mother cleaned for them.
Oh.
So they were sort of, these were the rich people that lived up on the hill, and they were exotic to me. I had always wanted to write about them. I had spent hours talking to various members of this family and other people like that. So the whole class, I'd go with my mother and she would clean the house, and I would talk to the cook and the lady of the house and the kids that live there. So I always was very strongly attracted to all of those rich kids because we were very poor, and examined them. I mean, you know, I would, on the rare times when I went to their houses, you know, I would ask the mother to take me through the house so I could see the way they lived. It was fascinating to me.
Explain what it was about the Tally family that you created, the family that was originally loosely based on the family that your mother cleaned for. I mean, what absorbed you in that family enough to bring you back about five different times?
I think they were America for me. I think they were changing so much. The war had had a very profound effect on them. The country was changing, and they were changing, and were not coping particularly well with the change. And that, I think, was the first thing that drew me to them. The whole idea of a family is very interesting to me because it's not at all the way the politicians talk about. We have to create a strong family unit, and everything is for the family. Well, bull hockey. I mean, families are about the most destructive things that's ever been invented. They're horrible. And there are so few families that work. Half the families and half the people in the country don't have two parents. You could name on one hand anyone in a class of, say, 60 that has one meal with the entire family sitting down together. That doesn't happen anymore. I wonder if it ever did. And also the meals that we had at home were the most horrible experiences of my life.
What kind of food?
Well,
it wasn't the company as
my stepfather telling us all how to eat, and you know, and it was his only chance to torture the family altogether, and so he made the most of it.
Do you have a group of people you think of as being your family, even though it's not a nuclear family?
Yes. The Circle Rep is my family, yeah. Either Circle Rep or there's another small little adjunct to that. I live in Sag Harbor, and there are few neighbors there that are also, I also feel of as very, very important to me.
So did you grow up thinking, I don't want a family, I don't need a family, I'm going to go my own way?
No, I grew up thinking, I'm going to have a family, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to raise it right, it's all, you know, everyone's going to love everyone. And that all just frittered away into nothing eventually.
Why you gave up on it?
I was completely uninterested in it after a while. Also, I discovered as I grew up that I didn't really like children, which was a real disappointment to me. But they're loud and noisy little monsters that annoy me and get on my nerves. And I really hate that about myself, but there's no point in denying it. I just can't bear them. Also, they keep the most destructive hours.
This is coming from the guy who stays up all night writing, right?
Don't do that anymore.
Yeah. I'm sure everybody would tell you that if it were your children, you'd feel differently.
I'm sure. Right. I'm sure I would.
Do you ever worry about off-Broadway dying, in part because of cable and television?
No, not because of television. I worry about it dying because... I don't really, because I think there's always new blood coming into mm-hmm. it. But there's always new people coming to town that want to put on a show, they want the experience, and they're going to find an off-Broadway somewhere to do that. And if they don't do it in New York, they'll do it in Chicago. Well, they're doing it in Chicago. They'll do it in Seattle, and they're doing it in Seattle. They'll do it in San Francisco, and they're doing it there in L.A. And probably Atlanta as well, and a number of other places. It's happening all across the country. They're now off Broadway, and off Broadway is in Seattle and San Francisco. So, really, when you're asking, do you worry about off Broadway dying? It's do you worry about new plays coming up and that energy dying? And I don't, because I think it's going to be happening somewhere, because there's always going to be people who need to write plays. It's just a completely different experience from going to a movie or from writing for the movies. There's always going to be people who are interested in the literature of the theater.
So what are you going to wear to the opening tonight?
I have to find a shirt. I've got a really nice a sport coat, a pair of gray pants that don't quite match. I've got my hard shoes in town. I'm going to wear my hard shoes and a pair of clean socks, got a clean pair of shorts, new T-shirt, and I have to find a shirt. Either that or I have to iron a shirt. I did all of my laundry, and so all of my shirts are very clean, but they're really kind of rumpled. So I have to go out and find a shirt or a sweater or something to wear with that jacket.
Well, I'll let you get to it. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
It's been fun.
My interview with Lanford Wilson was recorded on Wednesday, just before the opening of his new play, Redwood Curtain, at the Zillerbach Theater in Philadelphia. A short postscript, the New York Times reports today that talk of resignations abound at the Circle Repertory Theater after the postponement of the Broadway production of Redwood Curtain. Circle Rep's board has refused to provide the necessary financial support to bring the play to Broadway. Other options are being explored. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.